Yes, humanness is only partially achieved, I suggest, when it's achieved at the cost of this illusion that I am what I look like. But humanness is fully achieved. True humanness is achieved when I recognize the difference between my appearance, my functioning out there at a distance peripherally as a human being from the source here, which is not human at all. And then it seems to me that the human is truly human. I suppose this, in a way, is what is the New Testament and Christianity is talking about, really. The ideal man, I mean, represented by Jesus Christ, I mean, who clearly, I think, saw that he was one with the Father and perfectly aware, too, that he was the carpenter, son of Nazareth. And he was a real human being. Why? Because he got both poles of his being sorted out.
How does this fit in with ideas of having a mind centrally, having an unconscious, a subconscious, a whole lot of processes going on under the surface? Or
all that psychological stuff.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think we're in the, at least you and I feel sure, not in the market for denying anything that's well established and for which there's evidence. And I know psychology here, psychiatry and so on, all that stuff hasn't got quite the scientific status that physical science has, but nevertheless, there's lots and lots of evidence of a kind for the general findings of psychology and so on. I mean, the mind is not all of imagination. I mean, a lot of it is it's a very complex field of study. And a lot is known about it, and needs to be known about it, I think. Well, what is this business? What is my mind? It's interesting that so many of the seers and sages of the world have said, or the great ones have said, no, never mind about the mind, never mind the mind. The trouble with your mind is you think you've got one, that kind of thing. That's the kind of thing that Ramana said. And at a certain level, I think that's absolutely true. But there is a level at which the mind is perfectly real. Well, real, I don't know whether perfectly is the right word. It's got a certain reality. And, well, let's look at that. What do I mean by Douglas's mind? Well, really what I think I mean by Douglas's mind, if I really get down to it, it's not other than my universe. It's really, my mind is my universe, is an abstraction, a very complicated abstraction from the universe as I find it. In other words, it's the feelings which I find attached to the objects of the world. It's the thoughts I find that attach to the objects in the world. I'm looking at trees now. Now I've got feelings about those trees. I like those trees. I've got thoughts about those trees. I name them. I perceive them as beautiful, sometimes as perhaps threatening. We know they were going to fall down and hurt people. I don't know. I mean, in other words, the world as I find it is replete with feelings and thoughts, which I can collect, abstract from the scene, and put in a box here, as though they had nothing really. They didn't adhere to the object, but they adhered to me, the subject. put in a box here and call it a mind. Well, I don't find that helpful. I like the primitive, I think, and I would say perhaps like Ramana and company, why I can't find a mind of my own here in a box. I can't find that at all. That's absolutely fictional. And but what I do find is that my universe is replete with elements which I can collect together and label mine, but that's not a helpful thing or sensible thing or a practical thing to do. I find it far more practical to let my feelings and my thoughts belong where they do belong, which is along with the object. And in practical terms, just to illustrate this, just to make clear what I mean, and I'm sure you mean to, that by feelings, say about you, I can, or about any other friend, or even enemy, or whatever, my feelings about you, my thoughts about you, belong to Richard. They don't characterize me here. Richard is served up to me with color, with motion, with shape, form, and with a feeling of love or whatever. That's the way Richard comes to me. And I'm not going to take that, that affection I have for you away from you and put it in a box here, because it's artificial. I can't do it, and insofar as I can do it, it's sentimentality. It's getting something out of it for myself. It's making a personal, private possession of it. And so it seems to me that the mind is, when it's abstracted from the universe, is damaging nonsense and gets me into every sort of trouble. And it's unreal and worrying. Everything to be said against it. But when it's allowed to settle again on its objects, then it is rectified. And it gains very much in the process of being sent back to where it belongs. And when I took the world, took my feelings from the world, my thoughts from the world, and put them in an imaginary mind box here, they suffered on route. And it seems to me when I send them back, they get rectified quite a lot.
So you're seeing that the source of your thoughts and feelings is free of those thoughts and feelings?
Free of them? Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. That what I find here is free of thoughts and feelings. Exactly so. Exactly so. That I find that the source and the essence here is absolutely real. Absolutely real. Very, very vividly so. And it's there's no thoughts about it, and there are no feelings about it.
So
that's very interesting, isn't it? That this is totally devoid of thoughts and feelings, but perfectly real. And that is the source of the world is free of thoughts and feelings. But the world is full of thoughts and feelings. And the contrast there is total.
So this kind of attention, seeing, or even meditation, if you want to use that word, is not a matter of wiping out thoughts and feelings from the center.
It's putting them where they belong. Nor is it a matter of, projecting them onto others. I mean, the psychologists make great play, don't they, of how bad it is, this idea of how bad it is to project onto other people your problems. In fact, if I have a fault, I mean, say I'm a greedy person, well, I go around finding other people greedy. You can always tell a greedy person because he's going around finding other people greedy. He's projecting his greed onto them. And we do have this mechanism, don't we, of finding our own faults in other people that way instead of taking responsibility for them. Now, that's not what I'm talking about. I think that when that's a very choosy, piecemeal bit of projection, and that it won't do until we've had a total projection of the whole. And now that is safe. The piecemeal little projections here and there to suit my book, to suit my convenience. I project my greed onto you and say, greedy old Richard, he's eating too much, or he's going and stealing things from the larder and so on. And he nibbles at things between meals, and you know, and he's a greedy old Richard. I'm just talking about Douglas when I do that. Of course I am. And I recognise that. No, that won't do. But I'm talking about a global projection, which is not like that at all. And it's taking responsibility. It's not projecting things and saying, washing your hands on them and saying, greedy old Richard, nothing to do with me. It's saying the world is mine, and these qualities of feeling and thought which I project onto the world are mine, because the world is mine. It all comes from here. So it's not that bad piecemeal projection or rejection of one's pushing out one's problems onto one's thoughts and feelings onto the world and not taking responsibility for them. It's quite different.
What about that piecemeal projection and those knots and twists that we find in our characters or wherever you like to find them? What about sorting those out, of going through them, looking into them?
You mean
them?
One's own?
Yeah.
One's own weaknesses?
Yeah. I think there's a place for therapy, in a sense, for trying to sort them out, improve oneself, or clear oneself of them in some way.
I think there is, but the question, how do you do it? And I think there's only one way I can do it, and that is to become aware, really to become aware of one's weaknesses very sharply from the place where there's no weakness, from the origin. And any idea that by kind of gritting my teeth and somehow determining to, by willpower or discipline or that discipline, to change myself and improve myself and become rather angelic, you know, it's like a saint or a really good person or even a nice person.
Yeah, not necessarily becoming perfect.
I don't think it'll do. I think the great thing is to be alive to these weaknesses, defects, twists, screwed up regions of one's personality, to be alive to them, be perfectly aware of them from who one is, and to admit them to oneself. And I think that will do the trick. I think it will do the trick to look at them and in a way accept them. I say, well, look at old Douglas, what a funny old thing he is, and from who I am, and be aware of it. And in a way, not fuss about improving him. And strangely enough, the improvement will come as a byproduct of acceptance of his kind of very, very amusing, deplorable humanness.
I suppose it's not overlooking the centre, not if one is overlooking it, one is, in a sense, assuming there's something in the centre. And that assumption or even lie is bound to upset everything in the end. Mm. So you're seeing through the lie whatever else is happening.
Yes, you see, the trouble with trying to reform Douglas is, why am I trying to reform Douglas? What's the point? I suppose the only point it could be at all worthy would be to give people a less difficult time around me. But I'm not sure that I can do that. I think the motive for trying to improve Douglas is to try and give him to try and foist onto him the perfection of who I am really here, and kind of get him to share in this perfection. It's impossible. It's impossible. I think my motive for polishing out Douglas is very dubious indeed. I think the only safe thing is to be really aware, be humiliated by, be prepared to be humiliated by what you find there.
When you say that you see no body here, no person, no body, and yet you experience a body in a sense, having a body or having physical sensations, does that change your experience of the sensations of being somebody in that sense?
Well, I mean, there is a body. There is a body. But how is it served up? I mean, it's not a case of denying anything, is it? It's a case of just attending. The whole thing that we're on about is just looking to see. It's attention, 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 is all it is. And so one isn't trying to achieve anything. One is just trying, or succeeding, I hope, in being awake. And how do I mean, there is a body. Well, how do I experience this body? What do I mean by body? Well, first of all, I'm looking at these legs now and these hands, and that's bodily. And it's around a lot, you know, certainly. And secondly, there is associated with this stuff here, a lot of sensations. And I think if I really look at where I have my body, which is not to be inside it, but for it to be in me, as it were, as a kind of something that's always coming into my space and manifesting either visually or sensationally and through this sensation or that, to be aware of the way it actually is presented instead of the way I've been told it was presented by my being shut up in it. To have my body the way I have my body is really to have it in a healthy and enjoyable way, really. And it, to sum it all up, I don't know a better way than saying that I'm not in it, it's in me. And what is it? It is this assemblage of clues, of one kind or another, or evidences of something physical. And what are those evidences? They're sensations of heat and tension and pain and pleasure. All that added together, I call my body. But right where I am, well, what I am is capacity for all that. I am as free of my body, Douglas's body, as I am of that recording machine.
So instead of sensing, one is contracted down into a small thing in the world, one experiences that oneself as being big and at large and
absolutely unbounded. I mean, if one insists on having a body, I mean, even looked at from the point of view of a function, what will work, what is complete. This thing I was had identified with under social pressure and I told I was it, is just not viable. I mean, it's not all there, it's just a fragment of something. It's totally dependent on air and water and earth and light, and sun, sunshine, sun, the universe itself. And so the only real body I have, if I'm going to be realistic in functional terms, is the universe, none other than the universe. That is my body.
In a certain sense, I can't derive my sensations off from the world. Normally, yeah. I say my sensations are here and the world is there. My sensations are in a small body.
Right.
But one expands and is the world.
Yes, one's sensations are global. And just particularly if one shuts one's eyes, one can find no boundaries at all. And I mean, if we, with even with eyes open, there's no way of separating oneself from the world. An envelope around, it's like being living your life inside a plastic bag. You know, you shut up in a sealed plastic bag at that. Isn't it?
To imagine yourself small.
Yes, that's right. Hermetically sealed. And you're there and moving around and along with a lot of other plastic bags in this supermarket of a universe. Well, I mean, what's the change in that? A miserable situation. It's just not like that, is it? And the whole thing really boils down to this simple proposition. I like coming back to simplicities, you know. And if the human invention, the human device, which is a thumping great lie, is this pretense I am what I look like. I am here, why don't I to you there? Which makes absolutely no sense. I mean, how could I be at 0 inches here, what I look like is 100 inches. It's absurd. What a thing is perceived to be is a function of the range of the observer. Well, I come all the way out to myself and I lose myself and I find all of the universe. And the only way I can get Douglas here is to, in imagination, be eccentric, live out there 5 feet away, 1 meter or so away, gazing in here to poor old Douglas, central in my life. It's nonsense, total nonsense. And of course we don't do it, and we can't do it. But that is a human invention. Now, that's a human fiction. Well, it's possible to be human and disabuse yourself with that idea. And then you become truly human, I would say, more human, out there, not here.
With this seeing, extraordinary powers come one's way, don't they?
Oh, Richard, what are you saying? That's a naughty thing to say, isn't it?
But I'm not talking about
powers. Tell me about them.
Well, I'm not talking about the kind of powers that are advertised in the normal way. Maybe I'm talking about the same kind of powers, but they are available, so simply available in ways that we dismiss, even.
Oh, I see what you mean. If we just attending, we find we have incredible powers, are really magical. Now, for instance, I mean, now look, I'm moving those trees around. I am. I really am. That's the many tons are being moved around there. I'm doing it. Well, you say to come on, Douglas, all you're doing is to sway on your chair. I say, where's your problem? There's no swaying here. It's just the trees. And the trees are dancing above them.
Someone from outside.
That's magic, isn't it?
Yeah, sees you just as moving, the tree stays still. And you go, well, this.
Really when you travel in the car, in your car, moving them, the whole countryside, billions of tons are on the move. And what's more, I can stop. I mean, start them up and stop them.
There's unlimited numbers, aren't there?
But there are.
distance folds, one can move.
Well, I can abolish right now, I promise you. I've abolished the trees and Richard, and it's all gone. It's all gone. I now make you reappear.
Good.
Well, I mean, I take that seriously. I think God is extremely naive. You know? The great thing is to be as simple as God.
And just see what's given.
See what's given. And this is the marvellous thing. If we would relax into what is obvious, we should find all that we need. And it's kind of world. Hides nothing essential. The more essential the thing is, the more given it is. We imagine it the other way around. The more essential it is, the more obscure we've got. Ferreted out. But what is really important is given, free, now.
When one listens here, which is the same as looking here in a sense, one hears the silence in which all sounds are given. And I can hear my voice and I can hear your voice. My voice sounds different to me from your voice sounds, and it is a louder, different quality and tone and so on. Mm-hmm. But as I listen to the silence, I am aware that both voices are no distance from me, in a sense. I mean, they're both mine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in a way, one seems to experience control over one voice and not the other. But if one really attends very carefully, it's very hard to find a difference. And I, in a workshop, for instance, when the noises seem to be coming out of, appear to be coming out of this one, this Douglas thing, and then out of Richard's or Anne's or some, gosh, I don't feel that one of those is my voice and another is something that one considers the. One becomes the source of all.
Yeah. Along with identifying a body here, I've taken hold of one voice, haven't I? And when I see that there's nothing here, that all voices, all even voices, the bird's soul, or my...
Like all faces are yours.
Yeah.
Yeah. Marvellous setup.
Well,
and what is so beautiful, Richard, I think so beautiful, and it's really... They've really come home to me in the recent years so much is that what one needs is simplicity. And humility in front of what is given.
Possessions, owning things. When one sees this, one sees that one is all things. Not depending on how much I have in my bank balance, but just seeing that although here I'm totally poor, yet being so empty, I actually have and am everything.
Well, what is ownership? I mean, things can't own things, can they? Things are just knock up against one another, they touch one another, bump into one another. A thing just owns itself, is that. And that things as poor little things, poor wretched little things, but to know thing, which is awareness. I mean, this is real ownership. To own something truly is to be it, and that is to get out of its way and become it. Let it be fill you, and that's ownership. I own something when I'm filled with it. And I'm filled with it because there's nothing in its way. That's real ownership, isn't it? Real ownership. And the world is yours that way.
We resist letting go of this little person and everything this person owns and knows. But when we let go into being nothing, then it's such a transformation into a grandeur that is unbelievable, isn't it? Just owning everything, being everything, willing everything. And only through having nothing.
And I think one is very cagey about talking about results, but I think you and I know that this does make a difference. I mean,
it's a profound
realization. I really can't think of anything I want, Richard. I can't think of anything I want other than what I've got. I mean, if I can think of anything I'd want, it's something like what would it be at this time? It probably would be nice to have a pot of flowers there. But my gosh, I mean, this is just a passing thought. What does one want? Do you crave anything that you haven't got? I think it does put pay to acquisitiveness and greed in a remarkable way.
Surely this must be the most profound change, if change it is, that one can go through, from moving from just having just this little thing and not everything else, to being the source of everything, to having everything, owning everything, being everything.
There couldn't be
a greater change.
It's something of a revolution.
Totally.
Bouleversement. Yes. Everything is upside down from the way I've been told it was.
It is by society's standards, one cannot be everything. One cannot own everything. From the outside, I'm just a small person. And it takes...
Small to the point of minute.
Yeah.
Minute in space, in time, in the content.
So I have to really go by the evidence of my senses and accept that as true, like let it seep in almost. Mm-hmm. Because society is telling me something else and I've been brought up. And to believe something else.
Mm. And, I mean, after all, what does one want in life? Well, one wants something to do. One wants adventure in life. I mean, just looking at it from an ordinary common or garden point of view, what would we have in life? And I think this is a very nice formula designed for living. It is that one has... so many discoveries to make, so exciting, so interesting, so surprising, to find everything upside down, and there it is for this discovering, and for sharing with one's friends. I mean, that's nice, that's a nice design. I think that's, I mean, can you think of a life which is more valid, more interesting, more acceptable than this? Discovery is such a great, I think, I don't know whether we talked about it, did we, yesterday on this tape or not, but I conceive that people who got a lot of mileage out of their lives and really enjoyed themselves, were people like Darwin and Einstein and Columbus. Columbus had a rough time in some ways, but May had he had some thrills. I mean, think of what we've got here for discovering. Everything is for discovering because everything is upside down. And I would say the thrill and joy of discovery is we don't talk of this very much, but it's important.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really a great creative thing. Yeah. This kind of discovery is very creative.
Yeah.
And what's more, Richard, I don't think we've begun to. I think we've only scratched the surface of these discoveries. I mean, when Neil Douglas packs up, I mean, gosh, get him out of the way, and I think we have floods of discoveries coming along. and perhaps rather limited now by Douglas's little list of the things, and which people paid too much attention to. And you know, I think the field is infinite, isn't it?
Yeah.
Does God get to the end of his self-discovery?
No.
You mean say that, you know, in a few years, in a lifetime, in the work of a few little group of friends, they've covered the whole ground? I think it goes on and on.
Douglas, if you were to try and sum up what it's all about, just in a word or a sentence or so, how would you put it?
Well, I think we did mention, didn't we, one word which is certainly very well known. Summing up the whole thing, attention. That's the Buddhist thing, and of course, it's what in all Sachs's island, that's the thing, isn't it? Very good, attention. That's one way of summing up the whole thing. Another word I like, a magical word, is being awake and not in a coma. And it's about awakeness, isn't it? It's not about achievement, it's about being awake. It's a very, very good word. How do we wake? How do we stay awake? How do we come awake? That's a hard one. But it's certainly, that's what it's about, being awake. Other words, other little slogans which help. I think one that helps me and helped me recently a lot is that Zen saying, said by a number of people in different ways, only make for the center and the rest need not trouble you. The periphery will look after itself, I look after the center. Another way is another word which, another portmanteau word that holds so much is identity. There's only one problem, and that is the problem of my identity. All the rest of life's problems are subsidiary to that. If I get my identity straight, all comes straight. If I get my identity wrong, all is locked up. Identity. I know who am I is a cliche, and I try and avoid that because it's got psychological uses, that word, hasn't it? Therefore, I'm talking about identity. What is my identity? And it's a there are only two possibilities. There are two possibilities I really know. Anyway, that I'm a product of the world or I'm the source of the world. Now, which am I? Primarily.
When one sees this, one sees that it's the origin asking itself.
And then, of course, the wonder and the surprise, the mystery. Not knowing. God is a great not-knower. Humans know a lot. They're know-alls. They really get to know a fantastic amount. Look at mastermind. You know, all those questions, well, mastermind, the human being, God isn't a mastermind. God says, pass, doing the questions. God is the universal idiot. God doesn't know. And what doesn't he know? What he doesn't know is how he does it, how he achieves himself. And God is bowed over by the splendor and mystery of her own invention, existence, whatever. And that is a great unknowing. To know, was it? Lao Tzu, in the Tao Te Ching, who says, to know is shallow, not to know is profound. Something like that, I think he said, which is quite true. And if I base my knowing, and my knowing must be very provisional and as if kind of knowing, you know, kind of sketchy and inaccurate. If I base my knowing, like I know Richard, or I know a few things, in my life I suppose I found out a few things, in a kind of way, virtual way. If I base that knowing on the unknowing, because it's the unknowing where it's where I'm coming from, the unknown, I come from the unknown, I'm unknown. My nature is to be unknown and unknowable. And, of course, the knowledge that I am beyond knowing is the knowledge, is real knowledge, is to know that one is unknowable. To come from that, I think that's a magic word. And if I go forward in life thinking I know a thing or two, thank you very much, you know, I'm quite a knowledgeable bloke, and go forward with that kind of smirk and self-satisfaction. Oh, what an option am I missing? What am I missing?
Thanks, Dennis.
Is that the end?
Just about, I think so.
Just about, yeah.